We strive to collect only the personal information about you that we need to provide the products and services that you choose. We may obtain personal information about you from various sources. The types of personal information we may obtain include contact details, such as name, email, and postal address and telephone number, business contact information, such as employer's name and address, job title, and business email address and telephone number, as well as employment and professional license information, physical characteristics, such as gender and height, government-issued identification information, such as social security number, passport number, alien registration number, and driver's license number, as well as copies of government-issued identification documents, digital images and videos, such as images from your mobile device camera, biometric data, such as digital images of fingerprints, irises, and face, travel information, such as flight details and itineraries, frequent flyer and other customer loyalty numbers.
That is the privacy policy for Clear, a private company that has partnered with the US government and the TSA to skip the lines at security checks at some US airports. Why on earth would anyone give up all that information to a private company?
Well, let's say the soul does exist. It's very unlikely you can just sell it by signing a little piece of paper, right?
I disagree with you. The concept of a soul is a little absurd. But the idea of trading it, selling it, is no more absurd than the idea that the soul exists. Do you miss your soul?
Of course not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I do travel a lot, and I have TSA PreCheck and Global Entry. So in the United States, TSA PreCheck will allow me to go through a faster security line, and you don't have to remove your laptop or tablet or remove your shoes or anything like that in the line. You're pre-checked, so you still have to scan your bags, but it's a quicker way of getting through security. In the UK, they don't have that, but if you travel business class, then there's a speedier line. You still have to remove your shoes and things like that, but it's a similar idea. But in this case, they've pre-checked you. It's part of the TSA. Clear, on the other hand, operates in a number of US airports, and it bypasses even the TSA pre-check line. Now, I've got several problems with this. First of all, you're trading huge amounts of your personal information for a bit of convenience. I can be stood in line in the TSA pre-check and someone with Clear just skips ahead in front of me. But they've only saved 5 minutes at best. I have yet to see where Clear saves a considerable amount of time. But people still see it as something very convenient and something they want to do. Honestly, I don't think these people read the terms and conditions. Those terms and conditions you heard at the beginning of the show are real. They are from the first few paragraphs of the Clear privacy policy. And they say they take privacy seriously. They do not sell any of your information to third parties. Of course, they don't sell it, but they do provide it to government entities. And irrespective of what they say about encryption and how they take privacy seriously, it's yet another system storing copies of your identity, your passport, your biometric information that will end up in a breach. A few years ago, there was a security breach that Clear were involved in. Now, I'm not talking about data breaches, but there was people that were able to get through the Clear line without presenting any documents and skip the security checks. Now, I don't want to sound rude, but when I look at the people working for Clear at the airport, they don't seem to be as highly trained as TSA agents. They're just there to get people to scan their face into the system and get them through and skip ahead of the line. To me, this is going to be a huge treasure trove of information for nation states, Russia, North Korea, China, whoever it may be. They're holding information, their identity, their passport, their biometric information, their height, their employer, professional certifications. They're storing so much information, but people are not questioning their privacy and they're just trading all their information for convenience. I don't understand, as a traveller myself, why people are in such a rush to get through security. If you want to speed up ahead of the line, great, get TSA PreCheck. But to save a few minutes? Anyway, I'm going off on a rant. So next time you're in an airport and you see that clear line and the agents ask you if you'd like to sign up, don't be tempted. What a waste of money. And I'm just waiting for the day where a significant breach happens. And we'll soon hear about it when it does. In other news, Authy by Twilio have announced that from March 19th, that's next week, as I record this, they are going to be discontinuing support for the Authy desktop application. So that means if you're using Authy on your desktop as of March 19th next week, I would imagine that will just cease to work and you won't be able to use the app anymore. Anyway, this change with Authy has prompted me to review my password and MFA practices. Now, the fact they're removing support for the desktop app, I don't think is a huge deal. They're actually recommending alternatives such as authenticator.cc, there's step2.app, secrets.app, KeePass, and I'll talk about that in a moment, and 1Password. And you've probably heard the good advice that you shouldn't have your TOTP, or timed-based one-time passwords, in other words, your multi-factor authentication codes, in the same app as your password database. But let me ask you this. Do you have backup codes for MFA? You know, when you authenticate your MFA token, whether that's Authy or something else, the website typically suggests that you take a copy of 10 or more backup codes. If you lose access to the MFA token, then you can still log in. But the problem is, most people I've spoken to are storing those very backup codes in the password manager. Therefore, it's the same thing as using your password manager for MFA. Now, rightly so, Authy actually provides some advice on this. And this is what they say on their website. Generating your TOTP codes in the same database as your passwords essentially defeats the purpose of TOTP secrets. And you hear this advice a lot. KeePass has support for TOTP codes, they're your multi-factor authentication code generations, like with Authy or Google Authenticator. And people are right, putting all your eggs in one basket, having that running in the password manager can defeat the purpose, but not entirely. First of all, if you use a password manager, then you can ensure that you have a unique, long, complex password for each and every service that you use. Now, from the attacker's perspective, let's say someone found a password in a data breach and they try and access my email provider, for example, using that password. Well, first off, it's probably out of date and I'm already using a unique password for email that is more recent. Now, if they do manage to get my actual password through a phishing attempt, for example, then multi-factor authentication still protects the account. Now, having my multi-factor authentication, this TOTP code, in the same app as my password manager, in this case, KeePass. Let's talk more about that. I have been using Authy up until recently, and it's been installed on my phone and my desktop. If my local password manager, in this case, KeePass XC, were compromised, well, since it's offline, it's on my BitLocker encrypted PC. I synchronize over HTTPS locally using Nextcloud to other devices, which are also fully encrypted. Well, then it's safe to say that my entire PC would have been compromised. There's no way of compromising an offline password manager without rooting, as they say, the device itself. If they have access to my password manager, then it's safe to say they also have access to the Authy desktop app. Now, if you're using Bitwarden, for example, and that supports TOTP and you have your passwords in there, that's a cloud service, and your master password was to be leaked, then yes, it completely defeats the purpose because now your two-factor authentication is the same app. So it's not really a second factor. It's just an extra piece of information generated from the same app. But if you're using an offline password database like I do, I don't think it's a huge deal having your TOTP codes generated in there. Now, the best practice, obviously, would be to have an offline password manager like KeePass and then a second device such as a YubiKey or a separate device entirely for your multi-factor authentication codes. That way, if your PC, your laptop, whatever it may be, if that's compromised, well, then your second factor codes are generated on an entirely different device. That is the way I would go. So I don't think it's a huge deal with Authy removing the desktop app. But Twilio is one of those companies that do make me a little bit nervous, because what if they decide that supporting Authy is just not profitable anymore? In the tech industry, we hear a lot about layoffs, and I don't think Twilio has been any exception to that. They've got to focus on revenue. And it depends how much effort internally, in terms of engineering, it takes to manage the Authy app. I can see why they've removed the desktop app. It should save them some money. But what if one day they turn around and say, no, we're not supporting Authy anymore, and it's dead? The alternative, if you're looking to move away from Authy, and this is what I have done, is using KeePass for your TOTP codes, but creating a separate password database for this. Now, the way it works, I use KeePass XC on my Windows machine, and I have my primary password database with a very lengthy, I'd say at least 32 characters long password to get in. I have another database, which I call MFA, or you can call it TOTP, whatever it is. That's where you're going to have your codes. And the only purpose that's used is to store your one-time password codes. So you create an entry, you right-click on the entry, and then you have a TOTP menu, and you can enter the ID for the code. This is where it gets a little bit more tricky. Most services you use will present you with a QR code. Now, if they're kind enough to give you the actual ID that's associated with that code, you can just copy and paste that into KeePass and generate your codes that way. If not, you need an app to scan the QR code. Now, as you know, I use Graphene OS, and the app I have found to be the most privacy respecting and functional is called QR Scanner PFA by Sekusu Research Group. I believe they're an educational establishment. I'll put the link in the show notes. It's free. There's no trackers. There's no ads. There's no paid requirements. I like the way it works. And it gives you the raw data from a QR code. So from a cybersecurity perspective, I like this because you can scan a QR code and see what it's trying to do. It doesn't actually launch anything. It won't launch the URL in there or anything like that. So then the question comes up is, okay, what do you do on your mobile device? Well, again, I use Graphene OS, and the app I use on there is KeePass DX. And KeePass DX supports TOTP codes. So again, I've got two databases on my phone. I have my password database with a long, secure password, and then my TOTP database, which has a separate password to get in. And again, comes back down to your threat level. If you think your PC is physically in a position where that could get compromised, don't use the desktop app. Don't use KeePass for your TOTP codes. Use an entirely separate device, preferably something like a YubiKey, which you keep on you at all times. Now, I use YubiKey for a number of services, and I've got one of these tiny card wallets, but it's got a convenient pouch which just about squeezes the YubiKey in there, and I can use that on my phone or my laptop or my PC. So that works really well. So separation is key. But again, look at your threat model. If you're in a very secure location physically, you've got BitLocker encryption on your PC, or you're using full disk encryption such as Lux if you use Linux, then if your computer was stolen, you have less of a concern there. Now, what do you do with the backup codes, or indeed the QR code ID that the TOTP generates? Because that's just as important as the backup codes themselves. Well, what I do is I have a VeraCrypt container on my machine where I store other things such as the backup codes, IDs, anything really that can be used to recover an account that I don't want to store in my primary password database. And while we are on the subject of KeePass and offline databases, I strongly recommend that you keep, even if you use Bitwarden, by the way, that you keep a copy of all of your credit cards, your driving license, any ID, any important documents, passport information, any of that in your password database. Again, this does raise concerns by some people because it's putting literally all your eggs in one basket, which is the reason I use an offline password database. But I'd even say on the practical privacy and security side, if you're traveling and you lose your wallet, but you still have your phone in your back pocket, at least you've still got your passport information, your credit card number, your driving license number. That's going to make your life so much easier when it comes to replacing those cards. I think I have been rambling far too much there, so hopefully you understand where I've been coming from. Just to recap, number one, use YubiKey wherever possible. I think that's the best option. Second, use KeePass for your MFA codes in a separate database, and to scan those QR codes, use QR Scanner PFA by Sukusu Research Group. Again, I'll put a link in the show notes. And then for everything else, I would use VeraCrypt in have a secure container on your machine. Even if your PC or laptop or whatever you use has full disk encryption, I still prefer to keep that in a separate encrypted container that I rarely have to open, I'll be honest. But in there, you can keep scans of your passports, your credit cards, driving licenses, and those backup MFA codes. And as I've said before, I use Nextcloud to synchronize my KeePass database and other things. I use Obsidian, for example, for my notes, and I sync that with Nextcloud between all my devices. But that's local. I don't have that exposed to the internet. Now, because this is the Practical Privacy and Security podcast, I get it. This may not be convenient for everyone in your family. But since my kids were first using devices, they've used Bitwarden, because I would much rather have them use a unique password for every website and service they use, and then use something like Bitwarden, which is available on any of their devices, without them worrying about, has this synced up when they're on Wi-Fi at home? You know, they can use that when they're traveling, and it's more convenient. And as for 2FA codes, again, YubiKey, Authy, I don't think that's a huge headache for the less interested in privacy family members you may have. Now, I think for myself and you as well, our biggest threat here is potentially someone breaking into our home and stealing our laptop or PC, MacBook, whatever it is you use. Now, if you were to leave your laptop unattended and logged in, shame on you if you do that. Yep, even in your own home. Then someone accessing that device could potentially have full access to your password manager, your web browser, logged in websites, and all of the files on your disk. So even when I step outside, I lock my PC. It's a habit I've got into in the office, and I don't think that should be any exception in the home. And it's not that you don't trust your family members, but you never know who might sneak into your house one day, unexpected, and have access to your PC. And this is why I don't fully trust BitLocker, File Vault on Mac, whatever full disk encryption you're using. Because let's say your computer was stolen, I would feel much more at ease knowing that anything really sensitive is also encrypted in an offline password database and a VeraCrypt container, which is encrypted, which has scans of my passports and so on. Okay, I think we've done far too much of threats and password managers and file encryption. Let's talk about Windows 10 LTSC. I mentioned this in a previous show where I had placed an order with CDW. I was very excited. I was expecting to get a copy of Windows 10 LTSC in the mail, and they cancelled my order. Honestly, that's no surprise. I do think there is a 5-device minimum. You've also got to have a volume license agreement and an existing relationship with Microsoft licensing to get this. They're actually not going to just give this to anyone. I was hoping I'd found a loophole in ordering that online with CDW, but that's not the case. Now, if any of you know of a way of getting a legal copy of Windows 10 LTSC, I do know other methods, but we're talking legal copies today, then do let me know. I'd be very interested if there's a way around this, but I don't think there is. Now, 2 weeks ago, I was in Washington, D.C. I love going to D.C. I don't go that often, probably once or twice a year. But when I do, it's nice to catch up with friends and attend security conferences. This one was the SANS OSINT Summit. Now, the attendance was surprisingly well turned out. There were folks from the Ministry of Defence in the UK, law enforcement in the US, there were federal agencies, threat intelligence companies, cybersecurity, red teamers, a really great mix of people. During the conference, I wouldn't say I stumbled across any gems or treasure troves of OSINT information, but there were a few things I would like to share on this show today. Firstly, if you haven't seen it yet, check out the free tools by osintcombine.com. One of those tools is called whatsmyname.app. You can go to that URL. Again, I'll put all these in the show notes. Whatsmyname.app is actually a really nice free web tool to search for usernames. And I found some very old accounts of mine from 15 plus years ago that I had completely forgotten about. One of them had an old photograph of me in there. And if it wasn't for that one tool, I would have probably forgotten all about it. I've since deleted the account. It took me some effort to remember the email address I had used back then and gain access to actually delete the account. But that's a great tool to use. Now, during the event, there was a Capture the Flag challenge by an organisation called Skull Games. Now, I won't go on too much about them, but essentially they use OSINT to find criminals, mainly sex traffickers and other offenders, using OSINT to track them down. And the volunteers, now including myself, will use their OSINT skills to give them some leads. I think that's an incredible way of sharpening your OSINT skills and doing some good as well. There is another organisation called Threat Labs. They do something similar, both of which I'm happy to say I'm involved in now. But that got me thinking. We do need to start using OSINT for defensive strategies with our privacy. And it's all well and good just using OSINT strategies on yourself to find where you've been exposed. But sometimes taking part in an organisation such as Skull Games or Threat Labs or doing OSINT on other people can really give you insights and other techniques that you may not immediately think about. In fact, while I was at the summit, I did find someone that was more than happy to do some OSINT on me, and I returned the favour. Obviously, you want to do that with someone you trust, but it was a really good way of seeing where we are exposed online. Now, talking of online, I've had a huge headache with the Starbucks app. I'm not sure if I've mentioned this before, but I use an alias name, obviously, with my Starbucks account. I have an app with a My Pseudo number, an alias email address, and a privacy.com credit card. And I've been using that for, I'd say, at least 5 years now without any issue. But recently, I started having a lot of issues with it. I actually share that same account with a family member. That way, we can maximize on the discounts and offers and the stars that you gain on there. Just for the record, I'm really not a fan of Starbucks. I hate it. I think it's overpriced. It's terrible. I have an espresso machine at home. I like to make my own coffees, source my own coffee beans. That's my preference. But as I'm sure some of you will know, if you have kids, pink drink and acai lemonade, or however you pronounce it, all those things are incredibly popular. And nothing I make at home is going to be good enough. So, the Starbucks app it is. Now, what I think happened is they were using the app when out and about. So, using a prepaid SIM that I've given them. Whereas I am always on a VPN. And I think that is what flagged the Starbucks account. So, the issue I had was I could no longer log in to the Starbucks app on my Graphene OS device. So I thought, okay, not a big deal. So while I was in DC, I have a screenshot of the QR code that the app gives you. Now, because I had locked the account out and it needed a password reset so my family member could log in with their app, the QR code changed. So the QR code in Starbucks, or the actual account number for that code, is tied to the password somehow. So it changes when you reset the password. That's all good. I don't really have a problem with that. I think that's a good practice. But then a few days later, I got a strange email saying that they had blocked suspicious activity transferring $15 from one card to another. Now, I find this strange because I use a unique password, an alias email, which is completely unique to Starbucks, in an alias name on a My Pseudo number that I don't use for anything else. So, not quite sure where the suspicious activity come from. They reversed the charge. But again, they reset the account and I had to go and change the password, which in turn locked the family member out. So I decided just to call them and say, delete the account, refund any remaining money on the balance, so I could just start from scratch. So what I've done now, I do not use the Starbucks app on my Graphene OS device, mainly because when I'm at home, that's connected to Wi-Fi, which is always on Proton VPN. Now, instead, while I'm traveling, I use the web browser on my mobile device and the website for Starbucks. I can pay that way. I can reload the card. I've still got a scan of the QR code. And that way, the app is never going to be present while I'm connected to VPN. I don't think they were detecting the VoIP number or privacy.com card, but it wouldn't surprise me. So I'll keep you posted, but I think that's going to fix it. Now, talking of deleting accounts, I want to share a story on why it's important to keep your usernames and accounts wherever possible. Many, many years ago, this was probably over 10 years ago now, I had a Feedburner account. Now, this is an RSS feed that Google used to own. And at the time, I had a WordPress site, and it allowed me to use Feedburner to publish an RSS feed of all the blog posts I would write. Anyway, I heard that Google were going to be getting rid of Feedburner, so I decided just to delete the account and move on to something else. Well, before they removed the service, that left my username open for the taking, and someone registered the Feedburner URL with my old username. Now, because a number of other websites, including a large corporation which was aggregating my blog posts for their news feed, they started getting some unsavory blog posts in their feed under my name because it was used for a series of porn sites. That didn't make me look very good, and that was a lesson learned. So now I think we should be really careful before we just go deleting accounts. Just think what would happen if someone was to register that account again in the username, which then becomes available. Now, there's some services won't let you register that username again. I think that's great. I wish everyone would do that. Twitter, for example, I think after 30 days will allow anyone to create that username. So what I did on my Twitter was delete the account, create a new account. Once the username was available, I changed it to my old name, which was Ray Heffer in Twitter. And now, because that account was new and wasn't used, Twitter have suspended it. So if you go to my old Twitter username, it says the account is suspended. Not ideal. It looks like I've done something sketchy on there, which I haven't, by the way. Now, that leads on to custom domain names and why it's important to keep those too. I have a really, really bad habit of registering domain names. I could be up late one night thinking, I just thought of a great idea for a domain name. It's nice and short, and I will see if there's a .com available. And if there is, I will buy it. The problem is, it's getting expensive for the renewals, for one. But now I don't want to delete those domain names because if I've used them for emails, and I wouldn't say I've done that with all of them, but there's a good handful of domains I use with email. Now I want to keep that email forever. I don't want anyone else to have the ability to receive email at those domains. Now, let me give you an example. If you go to expireddomains.net and register an account, and again, I think they're pretty hot on VPNs and things, so be careful. They may just block your account. But if you have luck with that, you can look at expiring domains with short URLs. And I think this is a really valuable resource. First of all, I've registered domains here because it's got the word mail in it. So let's say flashmail.com. Now, I just made that up, so don't go there. It could be something sketchy. I don't know what that is. The point is, that sounds like an email provider. So I use that with simple login. And then all my throwaway junk email addresses are jeff@flashmail.com, that kind of thing. And the great thing with that is it looks legitimate. But the other thing I do on expireddomains.net is sort the domains by backlinks. Now, they call it majestic external backlinks. And what this does is shows you how many other sites are linking back to that domain. Now, that typically indicates that it's a very popular domain. It could be an organization, a popular web store, whatever it may be. And I do that because it's more than likely being used for email, and the email is not blacklisted, it's trusted. I'm looking at it now. There's a domain name. I'm sure this is going to be taken, but there's a domain name called rocketsteer.com, which is available. So if you want to go and see if that's available and register it, then you've got rocketsteer.com, and it has thousands of backlinks. There's a tag called ABY, which was the birth year of the domain, and that was 2018. ACR, so that's the archive org number of crawl results. There's 26 in there. So there you go. I'm going to give you a free one, rocketsteer.com. If anyone wants to grab that, there's an expired domain, which I would suspect has a lot of activity. Now, here's the other interesting thing you can do. Once you own that domain name, it's yours. You've legally paid for it. There's nothing suspicious going on there. If you decide to register that, let's say with simple login and enable the catch-all option, any emails going to that domain, whether it's jeff@rocketsteer.com, ray@rocketsteer, info at whatever it may be, you're going to get the email because you've enabled catch-all. Now, this is a bit of a grey area, but this could be useful for sock puppets. Now, again, back in the world of OSINT, When you're researching other social media profiles, it's very useful to have a sock puppet, or in other words, an alias account that you can use. So perhaps this is a fake Facebook profile. Perhaps it's a profile that was discarded many years ago that may have been associated with that domain and an email at that domain. I think you catch the drift here. And expired domains can reveal a lot of things that the domain was used for in the past. Now, moving back to our own domain names, unless you've never used that domain for email, then you're probably good to let it go. But in my case, I've now got so many, I've decided to register all the ones I've used for email for the next 10 years, just to make sure it's safe for the foreseeable future anyway. Now, something else I've been looking at over the past few weeks is the cost of my prepaid SIMs. As you know, I use Mint Mobile, or have been using Mint Mobile, but I found they've got quite expensive, especially when you're giving SIM cards out to family members as well with alias names. Again, why do I do this? Primarily, it's to protect myself against SIM swapping attacks. That's where a threat actor, anyone else, could pretend to be me, sourcing my personal information from OSINT online, and then using social engineering to convince the telecoms company to change the SIM card to a spare one in their possession. Now, unfortunately, this is still today an incredibly successful attack. Executives of large organizations can be targeted, knowing that they will probably use SMS for two-factor authentication for their email and other services. And then if you can convince the cell phone provider to hand over that SIM number, basically you're pretending you're the SIM owner, then you've now got the keys to the kingdom. Now, back to prepaid SIMs. I have started using Telo. I'm a big fan of Telo for one reason. They're really cheap and it's been working really well for me. You can choose the number of free text messages and minutes you want for each number. And I think it starts from $5 a month. So I know many of you have written into me in the past and said, you know, what do you do for VoIP numbers for services like Uber or, you know, any service that block VoIP numbers? Well, I have burner phones that pretty much stay turned off. They're in a tin, which is like a Faraday tin that I have. And when I need a burner number, I can get one of those spare phones out. I have a $5 a month SIM from Telo, and I use that number. It's not used for anything else other than those very few services that demand a physical SIM card phone number. But I am thinking of moving my main phone and family members over to Telo as well. Even their unlimited plan for unlimited data is a lot cheaper than Mint. So if anyone uses Telo, do let me know. And talking about letting me know, some breaking news. My email is back. lockdownpodcast@protonmail.com. Now, as you may remember in a previous show, I did have to disable that email address. I was simply getting completely overwhelmed with the number of emails, which is actually a really good thing. I'm so grateful that you're listening to this show, and I've been getting a lot of positive messages. It was actually just one or two not so positive messages I was getting that I decided for my own psychological well-being, I'm just going to disable the email and ignore them. But the email is back. Now, I cannot guarantee that I can respond to every email, but I will guarantee I will read every one. But I'm not going to respond to all of them. For that, I have Patreon. Now, my Patreon page is patreon.com/thelockdown. Again, all these links I'll put in the show notes. Patreon is entirely optional. If you want to support the show for free, you can do that on Patreon with the free tier. If you want to use one of the paid tiers, it starts at $3 a month. Then there's the ghost tier at $5 a month. And then you have the redacted tier. But at the ghost tier, I will be releasing these shows early. So if you want to have early access to the podcasts, then the ghost tier will reveal that. The redacted tier, I'm offering my session ID. So if you want to contact me one-to-one and be able to message me using session, then you can use the redacted tier on that. Now, because of the day job and the amount I travel, there may be times I can't respond same day, but that's going to be much quicker than sending an email and maybe not getting a response at all. So I'm going to see how it goes. I've got the email back, lockdownpodcast@protonmail.com. And I'll be honest, I love hearing from you. I want to hear what you like about the show, what you don't like, and what you want to hear on an upcoming episode. And also, what would really help me is if you just share this podcast, perhaps on Reddit, on your Twitter feeds, if you have any social media. All of this will help. Or even leaving a review on the Apple Podcasts app or Google Podcasts, whatever it is you use. And I'm actually really proud the majority of listeners, I won't say the percentage, but I'd say over 50% are using AntennaPod. So that indicates that you're probably using Graphene OS, which is really good to hear. And finally, I have a Twitter account, or should we be calling this X? Well, the account is at PrivacyPod. It's a brand new account for this year, so it doesn't have many followers yet. So that would be greatly appreciated as well. But do let me know what you'd like to hear on upcoming shows. Would you like me to get more involved in OSINT? Would you like to hear more around cybersecurity and what I do as part of the day job? Do let me know. Now, I have also been promising the complete guide to pfSense. I've recorded a video, I've started the in-depth blog. Part one, which is more of a primer to this, is already on the Lockdown website, which is lockdown.media. But yes, I have promised the blog and it is certainly overdue. I haven't forgotten, I've actually got a spare pfSense router running in a storeroom, halfway through setup. But because of all the travel, I had to abandon that. But I do plan to get back to it this weekend. Now, I will leave it there for today. I'm going to upload this to Patreon. So for the Patreon members, you will hear this the day before release. And I will talk to you next week. Have a great weekend.